The Break Store. Unique branded gifts for the holidays, birthdays, or just because. Visit us at www.thebreakstore.com. Hit the right black get in touch button.
Welcome to a new podcast show about stuff. It's the show about stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. Here's your host, Stephen Davis.
Hello to all. Welcome to this week's episode of the show about stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. This week, I have two wonderfully creative people who have had long careers in movies, live shows, and also being a singer-songwriter. My first guest is Kiera Wesley Busher, who has produced over 1,000 shows worldwide on multiple platforms, including live shows as a recording artist. As a singer-songwriter, she has recorded her new album entitled Sonic Comfort, writing three of the original songs. Kenya Cagle, a movie producer, director, writer, is the president of Cagle Vision, which has been producing films since 2001. Mr. Cagle's latest film, My King, is now showing on Amazon Prime and has won multiple awards worldwide, including this month at the Brazil International Film Festival and the Alternative Film Festival in Toronto, Canada. Welcome to the broadcast. How have you all been?
Fantastic.
Awesome. Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much for being here. How did the pandemic treat you all?
Oh my God.
At first it was like, of course, none of us knew what to expect, but it turned out for me to be like when it was a perfect storm, a bad storm that turned good. I was able to produce an album of myself, start a new show. So it turned out to be okay. A little rough, but it turned out okay.
But you probably wouldn't have done all those things if you would have been still working and doing other stuff. So this, it, as you said, it's a blessing.
And I've never been still that long, so.
Kenya, how was your pandemic?
Pandemic was rough for me. A lot of things had happened besides losing so many beautiful people. I got really sick in March. I couldn't breathe, couldn't walk, had no strength, and every day it got progressively worse. One day when I was trying to breathe, I decided I was going to call hospital, and my phone, at the time I went to call, my phone was not working for some reason. And I live across the street from Harlem Hospital, which is normally a 5-minute walk. It took me over half an hour to get from my house to Harlem Hospital, where I was falling and crawling. And no one offered any help or anything like that. So I made my way into Harlem Hospital. They checked my oxygen at that time. My oxygen was a 75 and we needed to be a 95. I really thought I was gonna die. It was the most horrible feeling in the world. While I was in the hospital, a doctor came over and he said, "We have to admit you." He said, "But I'm gonna tell you something. If we admit you, you probably won't survive." He said, "We don't have enough staff and we don't have enough equipment." He said, "So what I'm going to do is I'm going to work on trying to get your oxygen level up right here." He said, "Are you willing?" I said, yeah, of course. So they hooked me up and some other stuff and the oxygen. And about 8 hours later, my oxygen started to rise. In fact, it became an issue where the doctor said, "Listen, my shift is ending, but something inside of me is saying that I have to help you." He says, "I'm not leaving until we get your oxygen level up." Oxygen level up, he told me to go home, try and survive, and keep in touch. And I came home, and I still thought I was going to die. But I had a lot of prayer, a lot of people praying for me, and people coming over, helping me out. I couldn't go anywhere to get food. I was just too weak for that, but I had friends come over, bring it, and it took a while, but thank God my strength started to come back, and I'm here.
Thank you. Now, we're going to start off with how I usually start off the show, because I want people to know about you on a personal basis, starting from your childhood. And we're going to start with you, Kiera. Where were you born at?
I am from Wichita, Kansas.
And tell us about your parents.
My parents were from Kansas too, both activists, both high achievers in affirmative action. My mom was, she was just on the Today Show. She was the youngest and first sit-in participant at a drug counter. They were just on the Today Show with Chanel Jones. She was 15 when that happened. My dad was also an activist. He was an educator, then a venture capitalist. He had a Mesbic. A Mesbic is like Reginald Lewis had. It was a minority enterprise, small business investment corporation. He leveraged millions of dollars in minority businesses. So he did that. And that's really what gave me my foundation in business plan writing, economics. And I didn't even realize it. It was just like by osmosis, I kind of absorbed it. My mom was the first Black banker in Kansas. So I had those kind of parents, you know, Jack and Jill, Lynx, all that stuff.
You had brothers and sisters?
I have one sister. She's a school teacher in Atlanta, kindergarten teacher.
Older or younger?
Younger.
So you the big sister.
Big sister. The big rebel sister.
Where did you go to high school at?
I'm in Kansas. And then I went to college in Kansas and in New York.
But I'm getting you a chance to do a shout out to your schools.
Oh, no, I don't need to go. Kansas. Okay. Hollywood Heights. I'll just do Hollywood Heights. Wichita State, Shockers.
It was
Hollywood Heights.
This is funny because I went to high school in North Carolina and I lived in Hollywood Heights.
Wow, amazing. You know, Hollywood Heights has Antoine Carr. He was a basketball player, Cliff Levingston. So we had some nice, Darno Valentine. We had some nice basketball guys come from our school. So, you know, it's a basketball state, a basketball city.
And we had football players. Marvin Powell, who used to play on the Jets, was from down the street. And Kenya, tell us about you, your growing up experience.
I was born in Brooklyn.
Oh, yes, Brooklyn!
in Kings County Hospital, of all places.
And my mother was born in Kings County.
Yeah, I grew up differently. My mother and father were with me. They raised me, but my parents were poor and uneducated. My father made it to, I believe, the sixth grade. I think my mother was to the eighth grade. I grew up in Bed-Stuy. I was on Lexington Avenue. If you knew Lexington Avenue at that time, it was just a row of tenements and a lot of suffering and poverty over there. I was the first one in my entire family to actually go through high school and go in college, get degrees. I was the first. I wasn't the last. I was the first. Thank God I have a bunch of cousins and stuff who are also doing this thing and achieving it. My mother gave me great values. My father gave me great values. My father was a factory worker. My mother, she was a house cleaner. She would work and scrub floors and stuff just to make sure that we had a good education. I attended high school at High School of Performing Arts. And at that time, it was the High School of Performing Arts. It was very difficult to get in. When I went in, we had a senior by the name of Freddie Prinz, who was probably the most famous person that ever went to our school. But our school also is a school where Glenn Turman went, and Lena Horne and Diane Carroll. So Sidney Poitier's daughter was there while I was there. It was just, I went to a school with a bunch of kids and people with backgrounds that I've never seen. I didn't realize there were so many wealthy middle-class Black folk until I got there, because everyone in my sphere was struggling in poverty. But that was my upbringing, basically. It was tough, different things happening. I saw different things when I was younger that a person shouldn't see, and some people never saw or lived. But I made it.
And you're here. And they had, did they have a TV show, that Fame?
Yeah.
Fame was a
feature film by Christopher Columbus about our school. My high school, there's more movies about my high school than any high school in the United States of America. We had great teachers. We had great camaraderie. When you look at the movie Fame is actually a great, it really tells the story of our school. Our lunch breaks was filled with a bunch of dancers and musicians and singers and actors. And our lunch breaks, we were creating in the lunch breaks. We were dancing. We had dance contests. We couldn't even wait for lunch to happen. There's a song on the album, if you listen to it, called Shake It, Sadie. Sadie was actually the Black woman who was in charge of our lunch. And I think the lunch was 55 cents or something. Sadie made sure you paid for your lunch. She was a great person. And then we had this, there's a group that he didn't put in the movie. We called them the Whoopee Ladies. And the Whoopee Ladies were these administrative aides who were to help keep us in and stop us from cutting class and stuff. And they'd get us out of the hallway. It was a great school, a great place to be, great place to grow up in. When I Performing Arts High School, that's one of the best years of my life.
Okay. And I have to tell you, Kenya, I moved to Harlem with my young boys, but I wanted my son to be in that school because of that movie. Because I grew up in the arts in Kansas, but I wanted to be in New York, and I wanted my son to be in that school, but we ended up at the Boys Choir of Harlem. But for sure, that school made me want to be here.
Oh my gosh, it was a great place. Everybody's great, and we still stay in touch.
Wow.
I graduated in 75, and I'm still in touch with all the students. And we have a bunch of students who are famous and just doing things, changing the industry.
Yes, yes. Now, Kiera, you go to high school, you get out of high school, you go to college. After you left college, what did you do? Did you go straight to from high school to college?
Yeah, and then I also did an engineering program at Boeing too. So I'll tell you, I wanted to perform. Like I did piano, ballet, jazz, tap, guitar, vocals. I was always in music theater, my whole like modeling teen pageants and everything. Then I get to out of high school and my parents go, oh, my dad's, we don't pay for that. That's just something that you do. So But I understand where they were coming from then. So I go to school, I get married, I'm at Boeing. I was doing facilitator for statistical process control. I was achieving there. I hated every single day I was there. And I thought, do people really do this all of their life day after day come here? So I'm married and I'm at Boeing and I take a leave of absence. I go to the seminar. A lady at Boeing I met, she sent me to a seminar. It was run by Dr. Phil McGraw, believe it or not. I was like 23 years old. He was the one that told me that I didn't have to follow everything my parents said. What I did is I actually took a sabbatical from Boeing. I opened up a performing arts school, bought a theater. Nobody knew I was going to buy this United Artists Theater for performing arts. And that led me on a journey in production, film, all around the world. So that I'll stop there so we can go on to something else because it's a full story about
that. You got time to talk about it if you want to.
Okay, I'll tell you. At this little theater in Wichita, Kansas, I had models and I had talent. Somebody needed to discover my talent. So I brought my band to New York and I brought them to the Apollo Theater. So when I was at the Apollo Theater with my group, there's a guy sitting up in the balcony, Maurice Starr. So he sends a note down to me and he says, I want to meet you. You look like Halle Berry, yada, yada, yada. So it ends up, my band is there for the show. I have all these business plans. And he said, well, I wasn't looking for you for these business plans, but you write this stuff. You write this stuff? So I have all my work with me all the time. And I go, yeah. So he needed somebody to write for his business plans. So from Kansas to New York, putting my group there, I end up on a journey, starting with Maurice Starr. He had New Edition, New Kids on the Block. He was the producer of the year, grossed $4 billion with New Kids on the Block. So I went on this journey like Mr. Magoo, serendipitously through production and writing business plans through music, boxing, television. And then it puts me into where I'm producer for Montel Williams Show when I finally moved after my husband died when I was 30 with my young children. So it brings me to New York, fast forward. That's where I started producing television after that.
Okay. Now, Kenya, how did you get started in after you left high school of performing arts? And did you go to a job and then, or did you just dive right into the performing arts?
I never left the performing arts person, even though I did go into a job. At the time, I didn't understand business and the business aspects of what it is we do. I understood the artistic aspect because I'm an artist. When you're an artist, you have to act, you have to dance, you have to sing. These are not choices that we make. We have to do that in order to live. Right. And if it's not in your blood and in your system, and if you can get away with going a few days or a few weeks without it, you don't even need to be in the business. But this is something that's in us. We growing every day, you never stop. And so what happened was I wound up going to college and working at the same time.
Where did you go to college at?
I went to Empire State for my undergraduate and the Metropolitan for my graduate. And at the same time, I also went to New York Film Academy. So I was doing all this because I knew where I was going. And I always knew where I was going. It was just how I was going to get there. So I wound up in the day, had a job in the day and had my business at night. And I learned business from workshops and business opportunities incorporated. And at Metropolitan College, I studied business. My degree is in media management. And so once I started to understand it, and I saw that I really didn't need anybody else in order to make money and make a living in the industry. When I saw that, sure, we want to be widespread or famous and all that kind of stuff, but that's not what I was looking for. I just wanted to be able to make a living, do movies, do acting. And once I got a hold of that and you learn the process, let me tell you something. It's simple, but it's not easy. It's easier than working a job for 20, 30 years or having somebody else tell you what to do. I don't like being told what to do, right? Kiara, I was listening to you. I'm like, wow, that's sharp. I'm learning from you, but that's it. I love the arts and this is all I like to do. I love it. I'm happy that I make a living on it. I teach film and stuff at different places. I'm just real excited about what's going on. But that was my process.
Now, Kiara, during what time period? I'm not trying to get to tell the people your age.
No, I'm not going to tell you.
But during what time period did you come to New York?
So I can tell you that I came to New York. I came to New York in my 20s doing all that stuff, but I was just like exploring. I moved to New York with my sons as a widow when I was in 1998. Mm-hmm. And that's when I started like at the Montel Williams show. But I was always, I was producing my entire life, but now producing television. That was another thing, Kenya, that with producing television for talk, that was not what I wanted to do either. I didn't want to do that every single day and look for guests and tell their stories. I'm a performer. So I'm a producer performer. So mm-hmm. I need to be able to produce people who are performers.
Yes, yes.
How did it feel when you came to New York and you did your first show? You produced your first show for Montel Williams. You said that's why you came, right?
Yeah, New York was, because first of all, I was assimilating into New York with young kids and I was naive. I'm a Kansas girl. I'm still a little girl at heart. I'm still a Kansas girl in the city, able to navigate through the city. But I realized making it here in New York, you have a really great fulfillment because it's not easy. It was so hard just to find housing. I had to homeschool my children and work television. So that was tough. So I only did 2 seasons at Montel Williams show because one, it didn't pay enough money for me. Two, you go on a season, you go off on hiatus and you go on unemployment. I don't want to do that either. I can't be that unstable. And I'm more creative than that show would have let me be. So I'm grateful for that introduction, but there was so much more because I was in Harlem and I didn't realize it was Harlem. I lived on 126 in Madison. Then I ended up doing economic development on Lenox Avenue. So that means Van Woods was my chairman. So I was everything that was happening for me was unfolding magically. For me, New York, for me, it has been magical for 22 years.
I had a guest on actually last week and it will show this week. And she came from California. Her thing to me was coming to New York. It was magical city and it still is. So both of y'all say the same thing.
But it can be tough too, because I know Kenya was saying that he had the struggles in New York. I grew up privileged. However, I grew up, the reason me coming to New York and Harlem was, I would say, finding my Black. Because what happens is when your parents are assimilating, you are losing your identity still because you're still a Black woman. So all of a sudden you're assimilating. You're in these white neighborhoods and white schools and you lose your identity. I'm a Black woman and I've always been Black woman to the core. So coming to Harlem, I learned a lot of things. That's why I wrote the Harlem Torch magazine. You'll find it at the Schoenberg Center. It was just a blessing because I needed to write about Adam Powell and Langston Hughes and meeting Barbara Antier was my first interview for the magazine. Okay. Dr. Barbara Antier told me then, I sat at her feet and she talked to me. She told me that it was very depressing and sad when you lose your identity that way and you have to discover yourself. So she was one that I have, her article still is tremendous, the people that I was able to interview, because I was finding myself there. That's why it's magical. But also as a single mother and being a representative of other single mothers, of how tough it could be. And I discovered that too, and things that you have to navigate through just to get your family to survive and flourish in the city. So that I learned that.
Tell the audience who Barbara Antier was, Dr. Barbara Antier.
So Dr. Barbara Antier was the founder of the National Black Theater. She had been a dancer on Broadway. She was married to Godfrey Cambridge. He was one of the famous Black actor comedian in his day.
Okay. Now, Kenya, you, what was your first production that you did? Was it as an actor initially?
I was a child actor. My first production started in junior high school, and we were at junior high school 35. But the thing that was unique and significant about us acting as junior high school students is that we were so good that we went on tour to all the HBCUs. We went on tour to all the HBCUs producing Pearly, Ozzie Davis piece as a musical. And in our immediate was Kashif, the musician Kashif, and Fly Ty Williams. Fly Ty went on to create Cold Chillin' Records, which was evaluated at one point at $500 million. These are the people who were around us. So we had all this greatness around us in this class, ran by a man who passed away this year, Dr. Martin Drew. We had some greatness all around us. And that was the first production I did. Now, one of the things is, I came from public school 5 and I had a talent, and everybody, what happened in 35 is when you had a talent, they would put you in classes where your talent was. My talent was actually art. I could draw and paint really well. So I wound up in a special talented class for art, but at the same time, I couldn't do the drama classes because I was in the art classes. But what happened was I wanted to be an actor. I always knew I wanted to be an actor. I didn't know why I wanted to be an actor. I just knew this is something I wanted to do. So instead of me going to science class, I would skip science class and go to the drama class. I went to the drama class so much that it was a few months later before everyone realized I wasn't enrolled in drama. And the science teacher was telling me I wasn't going to make the graduation or anything. And we got together, the school got together, they were gonna put me out of the drama class, but I had already auditioned and got a lead role. And so we made a compromise. And what happened was I had to study science at home. And I wound up, because I wanted to stay in the drama class, because the deal was if I failed science, I had to leave drama. I wound up getting 90s and you know, I was like the second highest student in science, because I wanted to do drama and I wasn't interested in science, but I wanted it that bad.
What drove you to want to be an actor when you didn't come from that kind of background?
Now, Kiara, listen, I'm trying to make a good impression.
It's in you, Kenya. It's in you. I know. I get it. Go ahead.
I was a kid, 5 or 6 years old, and my brother and I slept in the same bed. And I used to wake my brother up in the morning. And I said, Leon, he said, what? I said, we have to act and put on a show for the wooden people. He said, what wooden people? I said, in the walls, there's wooden people that watch it. And Leon and I would work on shows each morning. Really, we had a wonderful series that we did, and we did it for years. And we enjoyed ourselves. And I didn't realize that I was honing my craft. I was really becoming an actor. And I wanted to be, but the thing is, I was shy. That's the other thing, Kiara. I was shy. So I didn't really tell anybody that's what I really wanted to do until I got to junior high school and I found out there was a drama class. And I went and I knew, and this is the other thing, I knew when I went to that drama class that once the teacher saw me, that I was going to be one of their top actors. I just knew it, even though I had no acting experience. But I was already prepared because I had done it every day. And then even when we auditioned, well, I auditioned for High School of Performing Arts at that time, I think it was 30,000 to one was your chance of getting into High School of Performing Arts. Not one iota in me thought that I did not make it in that school. I knew when I walked in the door that this is where I was going to go to school. We use visualization, right, Kiera?
That's right.
I had already saw myself in the school. I saw myself acting. I saw myself hanging. I saw it, and it happened. And that's what happens sometimes. And I wound up acting in PS Junior High School 35, went on to performing arts. And so from there, once I graduated and I went to Frederick Douglass Creative Arts Center, that's with Fred Hudson and those guys. And I honed my craft, my writing craft. And I realized I can make a living off writing too. So I had writing and acting. And then all of a sudden I discovered that, wait a minute, if I'm a producer, I can be in any film. Right now, this is the best thing about film and being a producer. I can be in any film I want, doing any role I want, because I'm in charge, because I know how to raise the money. I know how to shoot the film. I know how my films can win in festivals and go around the world. I know how to do that, because being a producer puts you in charge. I no longer have to wait for somebody else to make, if I realize, Steven, if right now, if I look and I realize that I'm $2,000 short for the end of my month bills, I know that I have to produce $2,000 worth of product and get it out there and get it in the seller. There's nothing, because it's in demand. If you have a product or service that's in demand, you got it all. And entertainment is in demand. And Black entertainment, they now have a section where you stream. It's called Black Cinema.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's the greatest thing since sliced bread to Black. And it pays when you go out there, and it pays. So
Kenya, at home, they call me the neighborhood bully, because when I was growing up, I was producing these shows, making the kids do my shows. So they still call me to this day the neighborhood bully, because I made them do my shows. Self-production.
Yes, Kiera, just like that, self-production. So tell me, I'm sorry, Steve, I'm ready to take
over. Oh, no, keep on. I'm loving it.
But the question is, Kiera, tell me a little bit about you and the kids in the neighborhood, because I have a story too I can tell you about.
So, like, I'm acting now and I'm performing now because that's all I'm going to do now. I'm not going to do anything else, but I'm going to produce, I'm going to sing, I'm going to act, I'm going to do that. So I've been off Broadway and movies now, but I would write my plays. I would watch, we would have the Jeffersons, the Good Times, I would look at those shows and I would go back and write my shows and tour the neighborhood. So my dad, though, as a venture capitalist, he really nurtured that entrepreneurial skill in me. So he would say, okay, if you're going to do your shows, write the plan about the shows. I would write the plan. I would make my refreshments. I would have everybody come. And they encouraged me. My dad would come to the daycare center. I would be like 8 years old. They would take a break from the daycare center at their lunchtime because I was going to put on a show with all the other daycare kids. That's how young it was developed inside of me. It's inside of you, I know.
Yes. Young lady, I'm so honored to just be here with you. I'm like, hearing my own story coming from you. And I'm Same. Like, okay. Yeah, because I did it. Oh, this is the other thing. I had a Super 8 movie camera where I lived when I was, I don't know, 12 or 13 or so. And we were shooting film on Super 8 with the kids in the neighborhood.
Wow.
Even today, I still get messages from kids that I used to work with when I was in high school, and they said, man, you first opportunity I got, and I loved it, and it has changed their lives. And that's the thing, Stephen, that's really important about what it is we do. It can change your life. This is therapy. This is growth. This is a rite of passage. Bill Duke had once said to me that acting was taught to him as falling in the dark backwards. See, because that's what it is. We go, we step out in faith, and we fall. And
tell people who Bill Duke is.
Bill Duke is a legendary director. He directed some of the greatest motion pictures we've seen. A Sister Act, Hoodlum, Deacons for Defense, Cover. He's a legend. In fact, in my book, he's probably the top, not Black director, one of the top directors in the country. And just to give you a little side note, he's actually my godfather, but that's right. So there's no bias here, right?
Was there music behind him when he walks into the room?
And Bill has taught, and he was a mentor too, because we all have to have mentors. You know, I talked about all the great people around me. We have to have mentors, and we have to be careful that, and for me, especially a man, I have to be careful that he gives me a hand up, but I just use that hand up and use it on my own, but I still have to do it on my own. We can't have the ones we love feed us. We have to go out. And every time I go out and I do a show or a movie or something, I always send, hey man, what do you think? And he'll give me an honest opinion. Sometimes I'm crying. Kiara, I may need to call you sometimes when I talk to Bill, right? I'm like, I thought it was the greatest. But the thing is, it gets better and better. I use that term, even though I know. I'm sorry.
One of the things that I can remember that I had a wonderful time at, I had a friend when I used to go out to Los Angeles quite often, and his name was Hedgman Lewis. I don't know if you all remember Hedgman Lewis. Hedgman Lewis was the... In the 70s, he was the world boxing champion for New York. But New York, not the world, just New York. But anyway, he had moved up to Los Angeles, and he was helping me do something. And one day, he took me by the set of Hunter when Bill Duke was directing it, and then he introduced me to Bill Duke. So that's a wonderful experience. Now, back to you, Kiara. You left the Montel Williams show. You're here in New York, away from Kansas, but you've got steely determination to make it. Now, what did you do from there?
So I'm always blessed. I always feel like it always just happens. So my dad was a venture capitalist, wrote business plan, so I knew how to do that. So I did economic development. I was on the board of directors for Boy Squad of Harlem, but I was a drafter. I don't tell all people that, but my bread and butter came from drafting. That means I wrote IPOs. I wrote the 10Ks and 10Qs. So there'd be the lawyer, the accountant, and the writer. So you're writing all these boring drafts for businesses, but that was my bread and butter. But that always translates to something else because I can write plans that are going to be like my business plans with my creativity and my imagination and my ability to crunch numbers, as Kenya's saying about when you know how to do your business and know how much money you need to make. That was magic for me in every single thing that I did. So I ended up getting economic development. I was an executive director for a local development corporation in Lenox Avenue. So my magazine was funded by the city of New York under the Giuliani administration, believe it or not. I got tens of thousands of dollars to do a magazine from the city of New York, a resource magazine. So those kind of things, I was just creative in doing things. So I went from economic development, then I went to education reform because the Boys Choir of Harlem was in trouble and I became really close with Dr. Turnbull. What I wanted to show then too is I wanted to show kids that they could make a living on this. If it's in you, a lot of times your parents don't want you to do that because they're scared for you. That parent fear gets on you. They want the kid to be able to make it. So they want to push that great singer into being a nurse. Well, I wanted to make sure I could also help the neighborhood and let the kids know they can make a lot of money and different ways to make money in the arts. Not only it's lucrative if you know how to do it, but it's also healing. It can feed your family for generations if you know how to do it correctly. And I learned how to do it correctly. So I wanted to pass that on to other kids. So I just serendipitously, my life just unfolded that way in production, in economic development, and in the arts.
One of the amazing things, and I talked about this at a different time, was I remember the time where you told your parents that you wanted to be an actor or a singer and you're going to leave your job at the post office. That job at the post office, you could leave a good job, but that's what pushed us forward. And that's more the theme of this show that I do, weekly show, is progress despite obstacles. That we have moved the ball forward, even though particularly in the fields that you are being in, that was like the top of the line for certain people. And you weren't supposed to be in that unless you sang, and you had to sing for me, not for yourself. You couldn't be your own producer. What are you talking about being? I remember when Bill Cosby, but also I say in terms of myself, that when we talked about buying some networks or buying some cable systems, it was like, are you crazy? And goodness knows Bill Cosby had the monies to do, but they refused to allow him to buy it because, hey, he wasn't supposed to do it. So it's such a great thing to see the change in life. There's no jealousy in terms of the younger folks now moving forward. It's, hey, we helped them to be able to get to that point. Because you got to build on something, and they built on us. What are some of the shows that you did that you are most proud of, Kiara?
I'll tell you some of the shows like that changed my life. Like, I'll say I produced Ron Grant. He had the Village Underground. He had one of the most famous open mics. So when I was at MIST, I was producing this most recent miss, producing shows all the time. This open mic with Ron Brandt, he was with Sony Music. Like he helped vocals with Mariah Carey and Beyonce, and he was a talent scout, but he had a famous open mic where everybody wanted to be at his open mic. So I got to produce his last open mic at MIST before he passed. That to me was a life-changing experience because it showed me that it was not too late for me to begin again musically. It showed me another area. I think that's important for me too. That's Ron Grant. And then also the Boys Choir of Harlem, I did a play with those kids. When you do a play, Kenya, with kids that are super talented in a school like that. So I showed them how to write a play. Mm-hmm. So I showed them how to write a play called The Century of Black, where we did the centuries of 100 years of Black. And we did all the performers in those decades. But to watch those kids and their gift, like you said, Kenya, with all the performing arts kids, put that show on at the highest level, that was probably one of my most rewarding shows, to watch those kids bring that show to life completely and to show them how to make money with that show. So I will have to say those are the two, outside of me performing, those are the two favorite things I've done.
Kenya, what was the first movie that you actually produced and directed?
Wow, that's great. The first movie I actually produced and directed, I'm going to say, is Good Night, Charlie. I'm going to qualify that. Good Night, Charlie, I produced in 2004. When I was with the kids, we produced movies back then. One was named Rock Heavy, which was a little gang thing. But my first movie, my first action movie that went commercial, that got out there, was a piece called Good Night, Charlie in 2004. 2004 is when I decided to leave the city of New York, that I was tired of it, and that I had already established and found a way to make a living off of what I was doing. And Goodnight Charlie, it's just really interesting, was about—
Where did you move to? You can't leave this hanging. You tell us you move out of New York. Where can you move outside of this great magical city?
I had went to Long Island.
Oh!
Home. I had gotten married, have children, and moved to Long Island. We had that nice middle-class lifestyle. I had the three homes, and during that time, I had the three homes, I had the cars. I was pretty wealthy and was totally miserable.
Because you moved away from New York.
Yeah, because I moved away and I didn't have enough time to do what I wanted to do. I went to produce film. So I stopped it all. I'm like, you know what? I don't really need this. I stopped it all in 2004. Left the job, all that, and just start making my own movies. Good Night, Charlie is really emotional. It's more emotional to me now. Good Night, Charlie was about my nephew. I have a nephew who he had gotten in some trouble years ago. He got in trouble because he was selling guns. And when he was selling the guns, he got arrested. And my sister and my family came to me because I was the only one in the family really with the type of assets needed. He was given a $500,000 bail. And I was the only one who could come up with that. So I came up with it. He went out on bail. And at the same time, it caused some rifts in my marriage. But in real life, Charlie did what he needed to do. He went through the system. But I have thought about it. And I'm like, what if Charlie didn't do what he had to do? Thus, we came up with the movie, Good Night, Charlie. And a few years ago, Charlie was at a Labor Day party a few years ago. And some guy came in, saw his girlfriend dancing with someone else, and start shooting at the guy that the girl was dancing with. And he wound up shooting everybody except that guy and his girl. He actually killed Charlie and another on that Labor Day. And so now the film is even more important to me and close to my heart, because last Sunday, my sister passed away. In fact, we have the funeral tomorrow. And both Charlie, her character, and his character are the main characters of my film, Good Night, Charlie, my first film. So that's why it's important to me.
Deepest condolences. Okay, now back to Kiera. Now, you have decided during the pandemic that you're going to put together an album. What made you decide to do that? And what was the process in terms of getting that done, particularly at that particular time when you couldn't really go out?
What had happened, I had already 4 years prior to COVID, I decided to go back to performing. So I was doing like off Broadway, I've done some small films and getting my vocals together again. I'm just sitting still. So what happened was my dad got, so that whole thing with my dad and Alzheimer's, my son, one of my sons is in marketing with Adidas and a lot of the high brands. So I was gonna do a song just for, record a song for a marketing thing for my dad. I did a remake of To Serve With Love, and that was for a commercial piece. So I did that. We did an animated music video with that for a commercial piece. And that kind of started, that kind of jump started me to continue to do it. So I finished that. I got to do that with the music director for Whitney Houston. And so he did Whitney Houston and Aretha Franklin. So I had the top musicians to be on that song. So I just continued on with these top musicians to do a full album. I'm a writer too. So I used to write plays and music when I was young. Composing music, plays, writing songs, playing the piano. So I wrote three songs on the album. So I wrote a song for my dad, The Window. That's out now. I wrote Melodic Stimulation about a producer. I wrote Broken and I wrote Love Vibe. So all these things were just coming to me while I was sitting still during COVID, because I've never been still. I was always hustling. I was always making money. Somebody's always grabbing me for their stuff. This is the first time that nobody could grab me to produce their stuff. And I could actually focus on producing what was inside of me my entire life. And that's how it happened. And I would go to the studios, I would make sure it was already like lights all down. I didn't go anywhere else except for the recording studio. That's how it birthed, because I was still. And I let my creative part of me be the focus.
I have an interesting story. Back in 84, I produced a demo of a couple of songs with a friend of mine that was a good artist. He was a good artist. And I had a friend here in New York who, his name was Paul Marshall. And Paul Marshall was the top lawyer for Polydor Records. So I took it to him when I came back and he said, I will listen to yours if you listen to mine. So I listened to his and said, oh, this is a good album, good songs. And so he listened to mine and said, oh, this is a good song. Mine didn't happen for varying reasons, but his did happen because he was also the lawyer for Whitney Houston, and it was Whitney Houston's first album. So I got to listen to her first album before it was released. So I thought about that when you said in terms of Whitney. So Kenya, after your first production, how did you move forward? Now, let me ask you this question first. Were you both producer and director of that first film, Charlie, or you just was the director or you just was the producer?
I was the writer, producer, director, and I had the lead role.
Whoa, you had a lot of jobs. Are you from Jamaica?
Yeah, I had a lot of fun doing it. And I started, once I saw how it was done, because that was my first time really applying what I knew about business. And when I realized that I can't be an artist and eat. Artists don't eat. I had to be a business person. I had to figure that part out. And once I saw what my motto was and that I could make a few dollars, I said, okay, this is it. I got it now. I just knew it now. It was Kiara's swinging a baseball, never hit the ball ever.
Right.
Then you hit it, and that feeling.
Yes.
Oh, that sweet spot.
Yes.
And I knew I could do it, and I knew I could get better at it. And you have to realize too, Stephen, that as I was growing up, I met a lot of writers who couldn't write. Mm. They had their names on films, but they couldn't write. And I had a small network of doing some ghostwriting for some folk who had big names, but really, so I got a few couple dollars here and there doing that and learning how to hustle. It was all part of hustling.
It's all a hustle.
That's what we do. We're doing all kinds of things. We are marketers. And that's what I love about Kiara. And see, Kiara's hitting it on the spot. So if anybody's listening, they want to get into the... There's the other side. First thing is you have to have that business plan, especially if you're bringing in other people and other investors. You better have that business plan. It better make sense. I mean, see, I do it myself, but every now and then I have to raise money to get it done. And I can't raise money without a business plan. I can't raise money if I can't sit down and actually talk about each and every segment, how it's gonna work. Mm-hmm. Because as an artist, and that's the other thing, that's why we gotta realize you don't have to be a struggling artist. But as an artist, you better learn the business. You are a marketer. Yes. I'm a film marketer. I'm not a filmmaker, I'm a film marketer. Just like Kiara, I'm just so impressed with this young lady, just listening to her story, because I'm hearing what it is I need to do and my story.
So, you see my marketing piece.
Yeah, fantastic.
Oh, I'm gonna fast forward to now, Kenya, because you have a movie out now that is actually showing on Amazon Prime at this moment. As a matter of fact, I went to Amazon Prime last night and watched it.
You like it?
Oh, I like it. I like it. Tell us about that film and what was the idea? What was the genesis of getting that film and what you had to go through to get it done?
It's real interesting because we shot that film during pandemic time. It was an idea that was brought to me by a young lady named Karen Rock. And Karen is part of my team. My company is called Kagu Vision with a G, right? She's part of our team and she was working with us for the last few years. And she said, Kenya, I have this idea. I want to do a love story. And she knows I hate love stories, right? Because I like to do gangsters and fighting and all that other manly kind of stuff. And I thought the idea was a beautiful idea. So we worked on it, recreated it. It's called My King. And I didn't expect My King to do as well as it's doing now. This is the fourth week of release and the fourth week it's been out. It's won over 18 awards. This week, I found out we won 4 more awards this week. On Tuesday, we were nominated for 3 awards at one. Then yesterday, we were nominated for 3 awards at another festival. It's growing. It's globally. It has won 3 best feature awards within the film festival industry. And it's called a lot of attention. I'm getting a lot of emails and people are writing and I'm being offered to do shows, some more shows and stuff. And I didn't expect it though to do as well as it's doing. I really didn't. Yes, we're on Amazon Prime, we're on Plex, we're on Tubi, we're on Zumo, we're on Zulu. It's in a lot of different platforms. In fact, right now, Stephen, today, I have 3 films on 17 platforms, which is the most I've had at one time, at any one time. We have a film called Killing Joanne, which is also an award-winning film starring Nixon Caesar. And then I have an exercise video out that's making rounds. So it's pretty blessed year, but on Amazon Prime, it's called My King. And Stephen, like you said, is a really good story. It's a nice tender.
I'll be watching that tonight.
Now, Kiara, your album is out. What are your plans in terms of promotion and performing for that album?
My dad had a show Looking In on CBS, so I kind of took that show over and rebooted that show to be able to do what you do, just tell other people's stories, but also to go live. So waiting on COVID and the pandemic to be over, the biggest thing now is marketing the music and getting out live. And that's what I really love to do. Is to prove that I can sing live and not studio vocals, but I love the audience. I like that energy between the artist and the audience. That's why I like Broadway. I like theater even more than doing film because I like that interaction with the audience. So the next thing is getting out there and getting booking myself and getting booked to do shows.
Okay. Do you have any tour planned or?
I have a lot of people. So I've been working the rooms in New Jersey, the restaurants in New Jersey. I just did an old show last weekend. So I get to do my album and the shows in Jersey, and then I'll eventually build up to more. As I start to grow, you start to grow your own fan base.
Okay.
I'm sorry, what's the name of your album?
It's called Sonic Comfort.
Where can we get it?
It's everywhere. It's on Amazon.
I think.
Tidal, Amazon, Apple Music, YouTube. It's on everywhere you find music, it's there. And you can call me and order it. I have some physical copies, but who does CDs and albums anymore? I have those too.
I totally plan on calling you and getting some information, picking your brain. I'm looking forward to Sonic Comfort. So how would you describe it as an album? What type of music is it?
It's eclectic. I could call it Sonic Comfort because it's just the sound of music So it goes from like dance music, country music, because I'm a Kansas girl, so I can do country. My country probably first. Mm-hmm. We had black radio on Sunday nights only from 9 p.m. to 12. I would have to take my tape recorder and put it up to the radio just to get my R&B music. That's how white middle America my life was growing up. So I have that country base, but it's eclectic. It's dance. I did a Dionne Warwick remake, Valley of the Dolls. Okay. I did the Lulu remake, and I did a Country Road remake. And then everything else I wrote myself.
Fantastic. I look forward to hearing it.
Your country side reminds me, I was involved with a factory in Liberia. So I would go back and forth to Liberia. And on Sunday afternoons, they would have country music in Liberia.
Wow.
And I'm saying, and the person that was broadcasting it from Tennessee, and he would say, "Hello, people in Liberia."
In fact, the guy, the animator that did the animation for To Serve with Love,
uh-huh,
in Uganda. So starting a connection with, to be able to like, do you see this with your films that it's now you have more of a global reach?
Yes, just, I love it. I love it. I'm making plans on going. I really want to go to the West Coast. I want to get it out there. I have a few festivals that we've submitted to that are in Africa itself. Yes, I want that global reach. I love those connections. Yes.
One of the interesting things for me was discovering that there was one person in Australia that weekly watches my show. And then there was somebody in Pakistan. Oh, wow.
Great.
That's great.
So
be global. This is a global world, a global economy.
Yes.
Everything has to be global now.
Yes.
We can limit ourselves if we want, but that's going to be on us, the consequences of limiting ourselves. In this world, especially, Stephen, what has happened with the internet, it has changed and turned this industry upside down on its head. Because, see, the barriers to entry to this industry was real high. You had to have money. You had to contact it. Now we don't have to have that. We can make money just by having a great Facebook group. In fact, my book, Nat Turner, Prophet, The Story of Nat Turner, it became a bestseller with no advertisement or anything, just because it was on Facebook.
Wow.
And I advertised it there. And so for 2 years, I had this great book that I didn't put anything out. And remember, to publish a book now isn't like in the olden days. You don't have to put 5,000, 6,000. I think it cost me maybe $15 to do my first publishing of the book. And after I did it, I saw myself making my car fare first. Then all of a sudden I was making coffee and lunch money. Then all of a sudden I was paying my rent. To understand, Prophet, the Story of Nat Turner, it's in screenplay form because I write in screenplay form, right, format. It actually took me 4 days but we have over 250 reviews on Prophet, the Story of Nat Turner. And we have just a whole bunch of things happening. That's for another show sometime, but we still got things going on about that particular book.
There's one show that I wanted to at least give you a chance to talk about. You did a show, I don't know whether you were directing it, you produced it, you wrote it, and you did it at Johnny Youngblood's church.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, you thought I forgot. I didn't forget.
See, I love that Kiera talked about the live audience experience. Kiera, because since the pandemic, and I'll go on to what we do at Johnny. When the pandemic happened, I'm part of Mount Pisgah Baptist Church. I've been part of Mount Pisgah Baptist Church for about 6 or 7 years now. And since the pandemic, every week we have a live performance. It's a cross between film and theater. Like this week, we're doing my take on Five on the Black Hand Side. And so I wrote over 50 shows between the time I was sick until today. And every week we're live, we do it 5 p.m. It's called Incarn LVT. We do it live on Facebook, YouTube, and Zoom. So that's Incarn LVT. And I went to, when I got the vision of Nat Turner, you know, now Kiera, I know you just met me, so I may scare you. You may not want to talk. I get visions when I write. When I'm writing and I really get into something, I get visions. I had an in 1998 or so, I was part of Ma'afa. And Ma'afa is a production that was produced at St. Paul's Ministry every year by Dr. Reverend Johnny Ray Youngblood. Mm-hmm. So I was in this production as an actor. And this production is called Ma'afa. Ma'afa means the great tragedy or the great calamity. And it's about the Atlantic slave trade. And so I would perform in it. I performed it for 4 years straight. And you have to understand, people come from all over the world to see this. Dr. Youngblood put this together really well. And I was an actor. And one day when we were leaving rehearsal, I was in a car with three pastors. And I was the only one that wasn't a pastor. And they were talking business. They were talking church business. And I was just sitting there. And then the Spirit hit me. And the Spirit hit me. And I said to them, I said, guys. And they said, what? And I didn't know what I was going to say. And I said, I'm going to be the one to let the world know about Nat Turner and who he truly was. And they're like, what? And I'm like, I'm going to be the one. And so I thought, I didn't know what they were going to do. They said, look, let's pray. Let's pray. So I left them. I had stopped doing my offer. I went on, I said I was gonna never do my offer again, but I went on and I kept having this feeling of Nat Turner, but I didn't really wanna do it. I didn't really wanna do it because I was doing all these other things. I had all these films going, I had all this fun going. I didn't really want, and one night I was home, it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I get a vision from Nat Turner.
Wow.
I'm using the word vision, because I don't want to say ghost or anything like this. I get a vision from Nat Turner. And I look, and he's standing there in my bedroom, and I'm looking at him, and he's looking at me, like, what? He said, yeah. And I'm like, you're Nat Turner, right? He said, yeah. I'm like, okay. I said, I'm losing. But I'm looking at him as if he's standing there, and he started dictating his story to me.
Wow.
He started telling me his side, how he felt about stuff. And I was so afraid, and I'm like, people don't have this happen to them. I called up one of the members of Reverend Youngblood's church. He had now left St. Paul's. He was at Mount Pisgah. And I said, look, and it was 3 o'clock in the morning. I said, Denise, she said, I got a visit by Nat Turner. She said, that's nice. I said, no, he's in my house right now looking at me. And she said, okay, Kenya, are you all right? Is there anybody there? Are your windows closed? Right? Do you need people? I knew, but then she scheduled a meeting for me to meet with Reverend Youngblood. And so I felt that was my calling, that I had to talk to Reverend Youngblood in order to get this movie produced about Nat Turner, in order to get Nat Turner shown. So I went, I met Reverend Youngblood at his house. We had a conversation, but the conversation wasn't just about Nat Turner. It was about our ancestors and what we went through. And he invited me to his church. I started going to his church, and then he said, Kenya, I said, yeah. He said, I need you to write my next production of Ma'afa.
Wow.
Ma'afa, he had for 20 years at that time. Wow. He had a great audience. And I wrote Ma'afa, he loved it. Every year for 6 years, I've been the one writing Ma'afa. We get thousands of people from all over the country. I produce and write, co-produce, because we have there's a young lady named Michelle Hawkins-Jones who worked with me. She's a producer and she's the director. Every year I write Ma'afa and we produce 4 to 5 theatrical pieces per year. Just when COVID hit, we couldn't do any theatrical pieces. So now they're on Zoom. I hope I wasn't too long, Steven.
Oh, I love that.
No, it's a great story. It's a great story. Mm-hmm. Now, what I want to do in terms of wrapping up is give you all a chance to talk about your endeavors moving forward, what you plan on doing, and again, how the audience can get in contact with some of your works. We'll start with you, Kiara.
Okay, so I just finished shooting a couple of episodes on a new young series that's coming out. I don't know where it's going to be. I don't know if it's Amazon Prime, but it's a play, Professor Masters. I was cast in another HBO film that's coming up. I play the ex-wife of someone, and then my music and Looking In. It's on Facebook Watch and YouTube Watch. And it's also on Sister to Sister Magazine with Jamie Foster Brown. And I'm just auditioning and doing my music.
Okay. Hopefully that soon you will be able to perform, and then I'll be able to push to my audience for them to come and see you, because I actually loved your To Serve With Love. I've always loved that song, but I've loved your version of it. So
thank you for sharing my music too on Facebook. I really appreciate it. That's a big deal.
And now you, kid, what's up with you?
In a few weeks, I'm producing a short called The Harlem Story, which is a BLM kind of program. I'm working on a project right now that I with Bill Duke. It doesn't have a title yet. I'm doing several episodes of that. I have a piece coming out this year called Dead to Write, which is a 10 episode, half hour each piece for streaming. I'm also doing a piece called Cross Connection. We're doing that in July also. It's a short piece. And then we're doing the piece that's out right now, My King. We're actually doing a sequel to it that we got financing and funding for. It's called My Kingdom. And it's actually a sequel to the piece that is out right now. And those are the things that I'm doing in the next few months between now and September. And of course, in September, I will be producing, co-producing, and writing my offer for Mount Pisgah Baptist Church, the live performance, because we believe that this year we'll be back in.
Where's Mount Pisgah at?
Mount Pisgah is located at 212 Tompkins Avenue in Brooklyn, New York. That's 212 Tompkins Avenue, right off DeKalb. And the telephone number to Mount Pisgah is 718-388-3900.
Okay.
Yes, Mount Pisgah.
Thank you all so much for being part of this broadcast. And we really appreciate that mantra, progress despite obstacles, and you all are showing that very much. So thank you so much. That's it for the show about stuff, the Stephen Davis Show. Join us next week for another show. Bye.
Thank you for tuning in this week. Hope you enjoyed this show about stuff. See you next time.
Hello, my name is Jewel. You don't need to know who I am, but you should know why I'm here. My grandpa, Stephen, is an author of a new exciting play called When the Break Happened in Orangeburg County. It's about our ancestors from when the break happened in 1865 until now. Many of my relatives are featured in the play, from my great-great-great-grandpa Stephen to my great-great-grandpa Stephen to my great-grandpa Stephen to my grandpa Stephen. Guess what my uncle and cousin's name are? Stephen. Go to www.thebreakinorangeburg.com to learn more. An online store has been created to honor those relatives and other families with products featuring the Break logo. Go to www.thebreakstore.com to purchase items today and help to produce this play. Please!